Hello, and welcome to Sleep Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios with Elizabeth Spires of New York Times and elsewhere, with Emily Peck of Axios.
Hey, Felix.
We are going to talk about Elon again this week. I can see Emily Peck's eyes rolling. Emily has a weirdly, I wouldn't say pro-Elon stance, but she thinks he's going to win. I'm not so convinced, his latest big vote that's coming up. We're going to talk about that prediction of Emily's, and we are also going to talk about Emily's other big prediction, which is that interest rates are not going to get cut this year. We are also, very excitingly, going to be talking to our boss, Alicia Montgomery, about NPR and what's been going on there. We have a Slate Plus segment about steel tariffs. It's all coming up on Slate Money.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
So let's start this week with our favorite man, Elon Musk, always up to some shenanigans. And he has a doozy of a shenanigans. I mean, it didn't come as any surprise because he said on Twitter many times he was going to do it. But after having his $56 billion pay package invalidated by Delaware Chancery Court, he has decided that he wants to pick up his toys and move Tesla to Texas, but not before he does a shareholder vote and asks the shareholders to basically give him his $56 billion back. Emily, you are convinced he is going to be successful in this?
Oh, yeah, he is going to be successful. And let me just add that his request to be paid all this money, record-setting, top, highest pay for a CEO ever of all time, comes on the same week he laid off 10% of Tesla's workforce, firing 14,000 people. Like, just the nerve of this fellow. Anyway, just wanted to say that.
And by the way, the same week that he had to recall every single Cybertruck in existence because yes, the accelerator pedal would get stuck because they were using soap in the assembly, and the soap would just dissolve the glue that kept the accelerator pedal on. I mean, like, yes, it was, this is just a kind of a shit show of a company.
Yes, it's not a good week for Tesla. As you wrote also this week, its stock price is lower than it was when it entered the S&P 500. It's not doing well. Perfect timing for Elon Musk to ask for this like outrageous pay package to be reapproved by the board. Having said all that, 100%. I believe this man will get what he wants. The shareholders will give him what he wants because he is Tesla. There is no Tesla without Elon Musk, I think. He's a brand, and you know, whatever you think of that brand, it's the brand the shareholders like and want.
Well, sort of. I mean, I think that, you know, there's still opening for somebody, another shareholder, to come in and sue him again for the pay package.
There will be no end of lawsuits. We know about this.
He thinks if they move from Delaware to Texas that this will, you know, protect him on some level. And what's the most amazing thing about this is that his representatives are making, you know, a case that this time it's different. And one of the things they said is that they've decided to incorporate in Texas because they carefully considered every other state besides Delaware.
Plus international. They looked at other countries. They considered incorporating in Mars. And they were like, no, it doesn't quite have the atmosphere we need. The reason why I was very interested in the Tesla share price when it joined the S&P 500 was that was the point at which Tesla basically stopped being a Tesla fanboy stock and started being a mega cap corporation that effectively all big equity fund managers needed to have a stake in because it's part of the S&P 500 and they benchmark the S&P 500. And those fund managers are all underwater at this point on their Tesla investment. Tesla stock is down 60% from its highs. So a lot of people who bought Tesla over the past 4 years have lost money. In fact, nearly all of them have. And given that, it seems that those people who didn't get any upside from this pay package would be reluctant to reward Elon Musk with $56 billion that he got for getting Tesla to a $650 billion market cap when Tesla isn't even at a $650 billion market cap anymore.
And Elon's demanding 25% of the stock, and he currently owns 13%. And he says that if he doesn't get the 25%, he will go pursue outside ventures, which he's already doing. And if I were an institutional shareholder, I would say, please do that.
No, I went back. This is part of what I did for my story on Axios this week, is I went back to when he signed the original pay package and looked at what people were saying about it. And one of the things that people said about it was, Elon is a little bit ADD, and the thing that this pay package does is it forces him to just concentrate on Tesla and not do 17 million other things. Well, you know, guess what? Now he has like an AI company, a brain implant company, a tunnel creation company, a social network, God knows what else. Like, he is the most distracted CEO in the world. And so it clearly failed. It was just like a badly, if that was the aim, was to keep him focused on Tesla, it totally failed at that. The other thing that people said was that basically this was structured so that he would get paid out this, you know, $50 billion only if, you know, effectively he'd managed to create a world where everyone was buying EVs. So the large majority of new cars being bought were electric vehicles. We're clearly not in that world either. People kind of totally underestimated the degree to which Tesla would become this kind of crazy meme stock and that its multiples would be so much higher than any other car company's multiples. Yeah, like, I feel like I don't quite understand what the incentive is for the big institutional investors who actually vote, because retail investors don't vote, to say, oh yeah, we have the $50 billion right now, but honestly, we should just let Elon have it. And then we're going to be asked to vote for his new pay package, which is going to be equally large. And we're going to vote for that as well. It's like, you know, Tesla becomes this machine for just transferring wealth to Elon. And Elon has said explicitly that his main role, the main purpose he sees in Tesla is to make him very rich so that he can colonize Mars. And you're like, that is not what shareholders should care about.
It also feels a little bit like extortion, you know, Elon saying, well, give me this, or I'm just going to, you know, not be present for the company. But it's just self-destructive on his part, because if he truly believes that he's the only person who can run it, then, you know, the value of his wealth goes down too. It just seems very ego-driven and not really, even on Elon's part, driven by any kind of vision for the company. He doesn't really have a plan right now for getting around the secular weaknesses that the EV market is facing.
So, Elizabeth, do you think he's going to win this vote?
I don't know. If he does, it'll just come down to math and some technicalities. I don't think that he'll win it by convincing anyone that he really needs to be winning Tesla.
The reason I think he'll win the vote is that CEOs almost always win the vote. CEO pay is typically rubber stamped in these shareholder votes, even though there's this say on pay thing where, you know, like ISS can recommend that shareholders vote down pay packages, and they do that, but it's rare that shareholders follow that recommendation. It's like maybe like 10% of proxy votes where they vote down CEO pay. It doesn't happen very often.
So what happens quite a lot is that there is a vote on executive compensation where they basically say, we disapprove of the executive comp. And ISS says, yeah, we disapprove of the executive comp. And then that vote passes, but it's not binding and nothing happens and the executive comp remains unchanged. And everyone gets to sort of pat themselves on the back and say, well, we voted against it, even though it didn't do any good. In this case is different because he needs to win the vote in order to get paid. If he doesn't win the vote, then he doesn't get paid.
Mm-hmm. I still think that most shareholder votes, typically they go with whatever the recommendation is from the company.
That is true. In general, that is the case. And also, like, the other part of this is that here on two, the controversial parts of ESG investing have been the E and the S, right? The environmental stuff and the social stuff, you know, the woke stuff. No one's paid that much attention to the G. That's been the uncontroversial stuff, the governance stuff. But at Tesla, G is the only thing that matters, right? And if you care at all about ESG, what you care about is that management is beholden to shareholders somehow, that it is not above the law, basically. And what Elon is trying to do by moving from Delaware to Texas is basically to remove himself from the one part of the law that has demonstrated that it has the ability to hold him to account. And it strikes me that any shareholder would want, at least in theory, the ability for Elon to be held to account.
I think there's that. But also, if you're a shareholder of Tesla and you're a major shareholder, you're probably more aware of what Elon has done within the, you know, internal mechanics of that company than you would be if you were just looking at a pay package for, say, a large established S&P 500 company, which you would assume would had more traditional governance structures, more traditional board structures. And Tesla is so heavily covered. There's so much information about what's happening at that company that seems dysfunctional. I think it's just going to warrant a closer look from shareholders than they would normally give executive pay package.
So is this a disagreement here that Emily says, yeah, this will sail through, and Elizabeth says, no, it won't?
I think he's just going to be sued endlessly until he has to come down and, you know, negotiate a little bit.
I mean, if you pull back a lot, like Elon Musk and Tesla are, I can't believe I'm doing this. Tesla is an extraordinary company. I mean, name the other new successful public automakers in the US over the past 100 years that people know the names of.
Profitable automakers. There are none of.
This company is actually remarkable. And I think that if you're a shareholder, you probably have some faith in it. And also, I think they just vote for whatever the company says they want. So I think that this vote will pass and Elon Musk will get what he wants, though he might get sued a lot afterwards. It won't matter. As we see with the guy running for president, you can overcome a lot of lawsuits if you have enough money and publicity.
The only other thing I'll say here, and stealing this shamelessly from Matt Levine, is that the pay package that was voted on originally was not a $56 billion pay package. The pay package that was voted on originally was a $2.3 billion pay package. Now, $2.3 billion is an absolutely mind-bogglingly enormous amount of money to pay a CEO. But it is a lot lower than $56 billion. But that was the sort of actuarial, you know, probability adjusted present value of the pay package when it was originally passed. Whereas today, the, you know, probability adjusted value, present value of the pay package that shareholders are being asked to vote on is $50 billion. So this isn't just a question of, like, can you please just vote the same way for the same thing that you voted for the first time around? Because it is, you know, 25 times greater than what they voted for the first time around. The first time around, there was a very, very high probability that Elon would wind up getting nothing out of this pay package. This time around, there's a zero probability that he would get nothing out of this pay package. And that is another reason why, you know, like, I can see why people would vote for a generous pay package if it aligned, you know, Elon's incentives with shareholder value, and that Elon would only make money if the share goes up. But in this case, that's not true. Elon makes money no matter what happens to the share price. And for that reason, I feel like it's that much harder to vote for.
I have one more reason it's going to pass.
Okay.
The appetite to pay CEOs a lot of money is endless in this country. The US loves to overpay CEOs. There's been efforts to rein in CEO pay over the years. They really haven't gone anywhere. The Boeing CEO, who is stepping down because the company has made an absolute mess of itself, made $32 million in 2023. And like, there's no effort to claw back the compensation. There were a few articles. I don't think anyone cared that much. You know, some progressive outlets were like, oh my God, but it really didn't matter. No one really cares. People want CEOs to be paid a lot of money. I don't really understand why exactly, but it's like in the DNA of the United States. So yeah, I think Elon Musk, because he's like the most famous CEO, is going to get people to vote for his ginormous pay package.
I agree with you about CEOs, but I do think that Elon is a special kind of CEO. You know, it's
well, yeah,
he's as much a personal brand as he is, you know, CEO known for his actual skill set. And I wonder how much, you know, the sort of degradation of the Tesla brand has to do with his behavior, but also projects like the Cybertruck that seem to be physical manifestations of Elon personality.
Yeah, my expectation is that Tesla as a company would clearly be more successful, would be putting out better products, because it could hardly be a worse product than the Cybertruck from a commercial point of view. You know, it won't get sidetracked by dumb things like Cybertrucks. It will be much more focused on things like the Model 2 that can actually, you know, rescue the company. Were Elon to leave, right? If Elon left Tesla, I think there would be much less internal chaos. It would be run by someone who was actually focused on Tesla rather than on Twitter. And it would probably be a more successful and more profitable company. What I have no idea about is whether that would mean that the share price went up or down. Like, it is entirely possible that it would be a more successful and more profitable company, and yet, like, because in the absence of Elon, the share price would like plunge by 90%. That is also possible.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the Cybertruck looks like an origami El Camino, by the way.
Before we go to the break, I want to tell you guys about today's Slate Plus segment. We're going to talk about Biden's proposal for tariffs on steel and why he is doing this, even though tariffs on steel don't make a ton of sense, but they actually do make sense. Elizabeth kind of unpacks that one for us. So Slate members will get to hear that at the end of the show. And if you're not a Slate Plus member and you don't want to hear ads, if you want to hear the segment at the end of the show, if you want other great Slate stuff, you should sign up for Slate Plus. Because with Slate Plus, you can listen to all the Slate podcasts with no ads. You get all the Slate.com content. You get a newsletter. And of course, the bonus segment on every regular Slate Money episode. And we really love our bonus segments. We're in the zone, in the cone there with Plus members. And they're often, you know, really fun. So sign up at slate.com/moneyplus. That's slate.com/moneyplus.
Slate Money is sponsored this week by Burrow. And you might be looking outside and thinking, it's getting warm. Spring has sprung. There are cherry blossoms. The weather is nice. I need to start spending some more time outside. If you're one of those folks, then how about this? Bring the comfort and style of being indoors, outdoors, with the Outdoor Collection from Burrow. Burrow is a new kind of furniture company. They're known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life easier. That extends to their outdoor collection. It is made for all seasons and built to withstand the elements. It has rust-proof stainless steel hardware and quick-dry, stain-resistant foam cushions. They also pride themselves on their weather-ready teak, which is grade A, FSC certified, and offered at a great price. I have two chairs and an outdoor sofa being delivered to me. I'm quite excited. And no matter what you choose, you always get free shipping on every order. That's not nothing. That's up to $100 for larger items. Slate Money listeners can get 15% off their first order at burrow.com/slatemoney. That's Burrow, burrow.com/slatemoney for 15% off. burrow.com/slatemoney.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply. So for our second segment, we're going to talk about some NPR drama. And to do that, we are joined by Alicia Montgomery, who's vice president of audio at Slate and a former NPR editor for over 25 years.
20.
So you know everything. Okay. So before we get going, we should just say an NPR editor named Yuri Berliner wrote a piece for a Substack claiming that NPR is now so woke, it's infecting the coverage, and this is terrible. And he goes into, he has a lot of details. We'll get into them. It's too woke, and everything it does is too woke. And employees of color are running the union. And I mean, it's really, there's some interesting examples. And Alicia then wrote a piece for Slate explaining where Yuri Berliner's piece goes wrong. But Alicia's piece really gets into the nitty-gritty of NPR and all of its problems. And I thought we could kind of start there. So Alicia, is NPR's problem that it's too woke?
Not by a long shot. You know, NPR is walking a tightrope financially all the time. And it's just kind of built into the way the place has to do business, which is that it gets funding partially from corporate sponsorships, which I think is above 35%, and then from dues from member stations, which are everything from big sort of shiny stations in major cities to teeny tiny, you know, college radio stations in rural communities. And then there's a small amount of funding that comes from federal sources. Now, in order for NPR to stay on the air, they have to please these center-left, and I don't want to oversimplify it, but sort of center-left, mostly white, upper-middle-class listeners. It also has to make sure that, I mean, and there's a serious firewall at NPR. Like, it's on another floor. The people who do the money and the people who do the news are on separate floors of the building. So there's a firewall between sort of corporate sponsorships and what makes it to the air. And then it has to contend with whatever is happening in Congress. And whatever is happening in Congress can change dramatically every 2 years. And so if you are doing coverage that feels too inclusive of Republican or conservative ideas, you're pissing off your listenership. And if you're doing stuff that is critical of Congress and Congress is being run by Republicans, then you're pissing off Congress. So people at NPR who are doing this coverage, it's always been an impossible situation. And pieces like Uri's just make it worse because it feeds a stereotype about what happens at NPR that's not even close to the reality.
But he has some numbers in his piece showing that it's something like 80% of listeners identify now as liberal, whereas in the past it was a lower number. Is that correct?
You know, self-identification is not really a scientific measure. And the way that listeners identify, it's like, we're talking about a country where, you know, in 2008, we had John McCain running against Barack Obama. Now, at that time, John McCain was considered a conservative. And the country has changed. So somebody who is like Senator John McCain would be considered a progressive from a Republican standpoint. It's like, it's not that NPR's politics moved. It's that the political feelings in the country have shifted wildly. And the other thing is that NPR was born at a time when there weren't all these other sorts of news organizations that kind of, you know, and I've just got to say it, condition their audience to think that what you're supposed to hear from a news organization is an exact repetition and validation of the things you already believe. And so audiences everywhere are getting more polarized when it comes to their political perspectives. It's not just NPR's audience. I mean, I know that everybody looks at Fox News as the example of, you know, you emphasize the stories that fit the narrative that your listeners want to hear. And you fudge a few facts. You put on a couple of people who you kind of ought to know aren't always telling the truth. And they tell their stories, and that becomes a news item within itself. You can say, people are saying Joe Biden is evil or demented or whatever, because people are saying that in your last in your last hour. And so it kind of feeds itself. And then, you know, you can see that in some progressive media as well. There is kind of an effort sometimes to be doing that same service for left-leaning audiences, where you're not necessarily manufacturing facts or manufacturing stories, but the stories that are given priority for your reporters are the stories that reinforce their existing beliefs. And if a story does not do that, then it's deprioritized. But for an outlet like NPR, that it's trying its best to be fair, if you are having conversations and you're doing reporting about issues that impact, you know, marginalized communities, whether they're marginalized because they're LGBTQ, or if they're marginalized because of race, or if they're marginalized because they're poor, that has become sort of a shorthand. If you're doing reporting on any of those communities, the whole wokeness, anti-wokeness cops are coming for you, no matter what is actually in the reporting. And that is another problem with Uri's commentary, is that reporting on those communities and reporting that the problem with everything is that, you know, white guys are in charge or whatever, it's not the same thing. It's not the same thing at all. And if you are a listener to NPR's reporting instead of somebody who has sort of a predetermined idea of what anybody who is willing to work for a nonprofit news organization, you have an opinion about what their agenda is. If you were listening to the reporting, you would know that that's not what's happening at that network.
Alicia, setting aside, you know, a discussion about how partisan or biased these media outlets are or aren't, even NPR, the piece you published on Slate really paints a picture of an organization, NPR, that's really indecisive, kind of like top-down, bureaucratic, siloed, completely missed the bus on podcasting, could have had The Daily.
Could have had The Daily.
You're basically arguing that NPR's problem isn't that it's too woke, it's just that it's sclerotic.
Yeah. It's in a lot of ways, it's like a family business where the business runs, but it's dysfunctional as all get out. You know, the product still gets done, but the backstory behind how the reporting decisions are made and how resources are allocated can be incredibly messy. And a lot of it is about, you know, personalities and sort of whose desk or whose group of reporters, which editor is in the ascendancy or has the closest relationship with the people who are calling the shots at the top of the division. And that changes. And one of the big challenges for NPR is that, you know, it's had a series of CEOs and a series of vice presidents of news. And, you know, there have been times, and I'm not going to be able to remember who exactly said this. It's like the organization is kind of ungovernable. It's really hard to fix. There's a huge sort of top leadership churn that happens at NPR quite a bit. And every time you have a leadership change in one of those two top places, you know, CEO and vice president of news, committees have to be assembled to evaluate candidates. People have to, you know, get together in teams and talk about what they want in a new leader and this and that and the other. And that's the same thing. Sort of a similar process happens every time one of these F-ups breaks into the public sphere, where, you know, we have to get a white shoe law firm to come in and talk to 15 or 16 or 20, you know, highly paid journalists or not highly paid journalists to try to figure out who knew what, when. And it can be, it's like throwing sand in the gears every 2 years for this organization. And that costs money. It costs money. It costs time. It's a distraction. And rather than, I don't know, fixing some of the problems and using one or two of these crises to really clean house and really tighten up the ship, a lot of the time, the whole consulting thing and the sitting in conference rooms, having a conversation about editorial balance and diversity and yakety schmackety blah, it's just window dressing. It's just, you know, psyops to keep the foot soldiers quiet and working at their desks. And then people in leadership are stunned when some other F up breaks into the public realm, you know, 2 or 3 years later, and the process, the cycle repeats itself.
When Emily says that NPR could have had the daily, that it was kind of the idea started at NPR and then was allowed to die. And because I'm, you know, a financial journalist, one of the things I think is like there are sort of structural org chart reasons for this. The main reason is that the majority of the board of NPR is representatives of member stations, and member stations hate NPR doing podcasts because it disintermediates the member stations and they don't get any money from them. So
it's attention.
Because is that like a deep structural problem at NPR?
I think that, you know, and I'm going back into my memory here, there was always sort of a tension about podcasts because of the reasons that you just said. This is one of the reasons why member stations have not historically been thrilled about NPR just, you know, doing its own kind of fundraising, you know, having a here's how you pay for NPR, here's how you support NPR, this whole backstory about how that's supposed to work so that member stations aren't cut out. And podcasting, yeah, that's attention because it's like if people are getting their, you know, podcasts directly from NPR and it's not going through member stations, well, they're not going to be able to go on every 6 months and say, hey, you hear this great thing or that great thing or this other great thing through us. But the way that NPR as an organization kind of handled podcasting, where, you know, in the, I'm trying to think of 2009, 2010, in that space, it's like they had some podcasting in the late aughts and they just pumped the brakes on it because it was a relationship tension. You know, I was not in the C-suites. I don't know what the exact conversations were, but the talk at the water cooler is that it was a thorn in the side for member stations. And what the organization does when it has sort of a messy fight, when it's facing a messy fight, is it punts.
So like on that subject, we know that in media generally in the United States, local journalism and local media has suffered even worse than the national media. It's like there's almost no thriving local media anymore. And the people who are making a success in the news industry are almost entirely national organizations. NPR is this weird thing where it's governed by local media. Like, the member stations control the board, and they have every interest in preventing NPR from being a national news organization. There is no way, really, for anyone with a app on their phone to just listen to NPR all day. Everything has to get intermediated through some local station. In a world where local media is becoming increasingly irrelevant and the internet has kind of eradicated a lot of those local fiefs, and where people aren't getting their news from a radio tower anymore, does it even make sense for NPR to be governed by local radio stations? Does it need a massive governance shakeup to be able to survive in the 21st century?
I think a lot of those member stations would contest your assertion that they're the power and that the national folks are the ones who are at their beck and call. Because these stations, they have really different levels of power and influence when it comes to decisions that are being made at what, you know, NPR people call the mothership. It's just like not true that the teeny tiny college run radio stations and the places in rural America, you know, have the same influence as the bigger stations do.
Sure, but like collectively they do. If they all align on this idea that they don't want a national source for public radio news, then they can make sure it doesn't happen.
They don't actually have a huge incentive to do that, though, because for a lot of them, the NPR programming is very popular locally. It's good for their brands. But also, you know, if NPR wanted to cut them out, a lot of people listen to NPR just via the internet now and not terrestrial radio. So,
I mean, this is, you know, there have been perennial fights over this, but there is no way to just go onto the internet and listen to NPR. For exactly this reason, you have to always like select which local radio stations feed you want.
So, Felix, one of the things here, and this is something that's in center of mind for a lot of people, like I say, the foot soldiers, is that this is supposed to be a public service. You know, it is not just a big legacy media organization. It is a big legacy media organization that has a mission and lots of people who work very hard there who are dedicated to the mission of making sure that people in Nebraska and people in North Carolina and people in Texas, as well as people in New York, DC, and LA, have smart, thoughtful, unbiased journalism that tells them who's in their community, that tells them about perspectives of people they agree with and people they don't agree with. And that's NPR's mission. So it's like cutting out sort of the member station component, these local stations, in order to make it more efficient, is antithetical to the mission. It's not just that it's cumbersome and challenging. Serving all of these people, especially people in communities that don't have like thriving local media, serving all of these people is what NPR is supposed to do.
100%. And I do feel like this is a little bit of a straw man. Like, I was never for a minute suggesting that local radio stations shouldn't be able to carry NPR content. Of course they should. The question is whether they should be able to collectively hobble what NPR does and how it reaches people who might not get their news from a local radio station.
I've been at one member station, but I spent most of my time at the mothership. And I just want to make clear that there are enough problems in NPR governance in Washington, D.C. that need to get resolved, that you don't have to step into the board or the whole complicated dynamics between the national organization and the member stations to find that there are problems and to start working on those problems. It's like, from my perspective, as somebody who spent decades at NPR, loved my colleagues and the work that we did when it was at its best, it was very frustrating to see people in leadership make the same mistakes, some of the same exact mistakes, over and over and over again, just because of sort of, you know, cultural inertia and, you know, frankly, getting high on our own supply, which is everybody is writing in talking about how brilliant NPR is, or a certain segment of the population keeps doing that. And that becomes fuel for people in leadership to say, see, we're doing everything right. The smart people think that we're awesome. So that means anybody here who raises a red flag or a yellow flag, whether that red flag is raised by somebody like Uri and has tons of factual errors, or that red flag is being raised by somebody like me, the leadership always has license to say, we're great. You don't know what you're talking about. We're going to continue to empower these people who've been making mistakes over and over again.
Alicia Montgomery, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you, Felix. Thanks, Elizabeth and Emily.
In rooms like this, news pours in from the far reaches of the globe. Here is a new form of journalism that radio itself has created. History in the making.
Slate Money is sponsored this week by Wondery, the podcast company that makes the best one yet. It's a daily podcast all about business. If you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that saved Abercrombie, or which real tech acquisition is like Game of Thrones, or the one financial equation that can finally solve climate change, then check out The Best One Yet. Every morning, hosts Nick and Jack serve up three of the most interesting business news stories and why you need to know them in just 20 minutes. So be in the know this year by starting your morning with The Best One Yet every weekday. Follow The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more. Wondery means business.
When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. It has a vast network of more than a billion professionals, which makes it the best place to hire. It gives you access to professionals you cannot find anywhere else. And LinkedIn does all that while making the process easy and intuitive. Hiring is easy when you have that many quality candidates. So easy, in fact, that 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. They even just launched a feature that helps you write job descriptions, making the process even easier and quicker. All of this is why 2.5 million small businesses use LinkedIn for hiring. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/slate. That's linkedin.com/slate to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Emily.
Yes?
You have, in private communications with me, since we work very closely together 7 days a week, you have said that you don't think there's going to be any rate cuts this year.
Yes.
Are you willing to say this in public on Slate Money?
Sure. I've already made another prediction in the earlier segment, so why not go all in on punditry and prognostication?
What is your reason?
So the reason I think that is because, to be specific, this year, 2024, inflation has reaccelerated a bit and it's running a little hotter than people wanted. The other reason I think that we aren't going to see rate cuts is that the economy is doing fine. Nay, I say great. The unemployment rate is low. The job market looks really strong. Retail sales, good. Consumer spending, good. Yes, people are taking on more debt, and debt is more expensive, and the housing market has its issues, blah, blah, blah. We've talked about all of this. But overall, the economy is doing really, really well. There's no reason to cut rates. You wouldn't want to cut rates and endanger maybe pushing inflation even higher. And I mean, if you go and you like look up a chart of every time the Fed has cut rates, it cuts when like things aren't going well. There's usually a recession bar right after the cut. You know what I mean? I don't see it happening.
Yeah, the Fed has this dual mandate. It needs to have stable prices and full employment. That's the goal. And normally this dual mandate pulls it in like two directions. In order to get more people employed and achieve full employment, it wants to cut rates. But in order to keep inflation under control, it wants to hike rates. And so there's that tension there. Right now, it has achieved its full employment mandate. It has achieved it for some years. And so there is no mandatory, in the technical sense of the term, reason for them to cut rates. They have the full employment already. So, yeah, I think on that level, you're absolutely right. Like, what would be the stated reason for cutting rates?
I think it wouldn't just be, I think the biggest lever would be if consumer spending dropped enormously.
For me, the main reason to cut rates is a sort of mathematical one. When the Fed hiked rates up to 5.25%, inflation was much higher than it is right now. So real rates, the real Fed funds rate was lower than it is right now. Like, this is a little bit of like weird arithmetic, which is not easy to get your mind around, but effectively, as inflation has been coming down, every basis point that inflation comes down is a basis point that real rates are rising. And so effectively, what the Fed has been doing is it has been tightening monetary policy all the way along by increasing real rates, by keeping nominal rates steady. And so they could afford to cut nominal rates a little bit just to reflect the success they have had on the inflation front. That's, for me, the sort of the main reason to cut, but it's such a weird mathematical reason that I don't think it's going to carry a huge amount of weight.
I guess my question is, so before we got to the world we're in now, where we have relatively high rates, we were stuck for over 10 years in a low rate world and low inflation world. And that was its own thing, slow growth. It was kind of a bummer. Remember?
I remember that very well. And one of the things I cited in my piece about this was the Money Talks podcast that I had with Gary Stevenson right here on Slate Money. And he made millions and millions of dollars by betting that everything would be shit for much longer than people thought. And that worked until it didn't. Now we're in this Phoenix economy, to coin a phrase, and everything, you know, the way you make millions and millions of dollars is by betting that the economy is going to run hotter than people expected. That, like, you know, the recession that everyone predicted just didn't come. And if you took the other side of the recession, we're in a recession already. The recession's about to begin. If you took the other side of that bet, you'd have made a fortune in the rates market.
It's the reverse of when Gary was trading. Everyone was like, the rate hikes are coming. They're coming. The Fed is going to raise rates. And now the rate cuts are coming. They're coming. The Fed. No, first of all, no one knows. Like, I'm saying, I know that there will be no rate cuts this year, but I have no idea. There could be a big calamity could happen. We could have a big war in the Middle East. Something terrible could make a big hit to the economy. And if something like that does happen, the Fed, of course, would probably cut rates, you know? So you really can't predict it. But it certainly seems like the economy is running pretty hot and there's no reason to cut rates and juice that heat further.
Okay, let's have a numbers round. My number is 14, which is the number of vehicles in President Trump's motorcade that passes by my window 4 days a week as he makes his way to court. And so, yeah, one of the things I see as I'm having my morning coffee in the morning and I look out the window is this is the road outside my apartment gets closed down and there are police lining both sides of the street and they won't allow any traffic. And then this 14-car motorcade comes, you know, driving down the street and hangs a right up to the courthouse where he is currently on trial. And that is going to go on for weeks. But yeah, in case you ever wondered how many cars he has in his motorcade, it's 14.
Are like a few of them just filled with lawyers? Like how, what, what
are any of them stretch limos that have gold?
And not one of them, there's like a big sort of like Sprinter van type thing, but no stretch limos.
Like who is even in all the cars? I don't even understand.
It's a really good question. Elizabeth, you have a number?
Yeah, my number is 100, and that is the upper level of a 0 to 100 scale on something called the forgiveness scale that you get rated on if you are playing with a chatbot called Angry AF. And the point of Angry AF is that it mimics an angry girlfriend who you're having an argument with. And this was created by a social media marketer who decided that all of her exes were really bad at communication. So she built this on top of GPT-4. And now whenever you talk to it, it gives you an irritated response back and then you respond with something and then it rates you on 0 to 100 about how good the response was. And it's sort of like programmed to be irritable. So if you ask it, how are you today? It'll say something like, oh, so now you care about how I am today. And there's one particular mode where it says angry for no reason. And so anything you say to the bot, it snaps at you. And then you have to figure out what to say back that's going to rank on the scale.
Why does it have to be gendered?
I don't know.
Emily, what's your number?
Well, before I tell you my number, Felix, I have to issue a correction. Last week on the show, I said that Pilot's song Magic was released in the 1960s. That was incorrect. It was, in fact, released in 1974 in the UK. So I'm sorry about that. But my number this week is 68 million. That is the estimated amount of change, the dollar amount of change that Americans throw away, throw in the garbage each year. $68 million.
That's nothing.
To you, that's nothing.
There's 300 million Americans. That's like a fraction of a dollar per American.
So the point is, people are throwing money. Literally, Americans are so rich, they're throwing their money away.
Because
it's crazy.
Because American coins are, can I say this, dumb as fuck?
Sure. Like,
okay. This is where I come out with my fire hot take, which is the penny, the dime, and the nickel all need to be a dollar, or all need to be abolished.
Noted.
And if we abolished all pennies, dimes, and nickels, then we wouldn't have this problem, which, by the way, is a tiny problem. It is, you know, what is it, 40 cents per person? It's nothing.
Well, it's something for this waste management company called ReWorld that was written about in the Wall Street Journal, which is where I got my number. 7 years ago, they were like, you know what? People are throwing away a lot of change. They created a whole system so that when they are looking through their garbage, when they're doing their waste management work, they're filtering out the change. And so over the past, and you're going to denigrate this number too, Felix, but I don't care. Over the past 7 years, they have collected $10 million in garbage coins that people don't want. This is crazy to me. I am weirdly obsessed with coins. I've made us talk about them several times. We did a whole segment on dimes, if you don't remember.
Is this profitable for them? Or does the cost of like taking these coins and counting the coins and bagging the coins and banking the coins, like by the time they've done that, like have they actually made any money?
I don't think the story says if it's profitable for them or not. It said that they collected 10 million technically of coins, but only 6 million of the coins were actually usable because some of them get mangled. So I don't know. Maybe it's not. The point is that people shouldn't throw away money. That's crazy.
So what should they do with it? It's very heavy and it's very dirty and it needs to get put somewhere. So what are we meant to do with it?
You want me to tell you how to spend your coins?
I should spend them. Is that what you're saying? I should like take them to a store and be like, here, I know you're charging me $3 for a coffee, but let me pay you in pennies.
No, I mean, you put a few coins in your, I have a little zipper on my wallet. I put the coins in and then occasionally when I feel like being crazy, I pay in cash and they say, this is $3.75 for the coffee. So I go, oh, hang on, I have 75 cents. And then I give, you know.
And you pick out your three quarters, which are the only coins anyone ever actually uses.
Yesterday I paid for something that was like $9.62 and I got out my 62 cents. I did. I used two nickels. And I'm here to say everyone should be spending their money. Do not throw away your money. That's crazy.
I agree with don't throw your money away. I will say I have thrown away the odd penny or something that was encrusted in hard gum because it's not worth my time to clean it off. But
fair.
So what do you do with your pennies that are not encrusted with hard gum?
I do have like a sort of change jar that maybe like once a year I'll take it to Coinstar or something. Mm-hmm. And then it's like $250 or something.
Look at that.
That's amazing. I feel like I have pretty successfully transitioned to an almost entirely cashless existence. And so the amount of change I receive these days is basically zero.
Well, good for you for achieving this sort of moral superiority where you don't throw away change, you don't use change. I'm just saying, public service announcement, don't throw your change away.
On which note, I think we will wrap it up for this week. Many thanks to the whole crew, not just Jared Downing, and Shayna Roth, but also the DC crew, which is Patrick Fort and Alicia Montgomery, and basically everyone at Slate for bringing this amazing podcast together. Thanks to you guys for emailing us on slatemoney@slate.com. And we'll be back next week with more Slate Money.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.